All right. Good morning. Welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Jam, Steve.
Hey, everyone. How's it going, David?
Good. And we are unfortunately missing Max again, so it'll be another Maxless episode. If you're only here to see Max, you're going to be sadly disappointed. But I think next week he'll be in, and we may all be in physically. I don't know if that's yet going to be the case. I'm definitely back in San Francisco, so hopefully we'll get to at least see you guys all in person, and hopefully maybe we even get to do our jam in person.
I didn't even know did you just dox where I'm at, David?
San Francisco?
San Francisco.
Oh, I thought you previously doxed yourself even
worse. I don't
know
if we've ever disclosed where we're at when we're recording, but...
Oh, yeah, really?
I'm in San Francisco.
Everybody knows your birthday. That was the big dox, because that's obviously your password on your Gmail.
Birthday, location, everything. Yeah, private key.
So, speaking of things that go wrong, there's this news that came out this morning of things going horribly wrong. And I know it's kind of like it's all developing and we're trying to figure out exactly what's going on. But when I saw it, I didn't even fully understand how to interpret it. So the story, I'll tee up with at least kind of reading the announcement. So there's this company called Bybit. I guess they're a Bitcoin exchange or a Web3 crypto exchange, it appears. I assume they're second tier or third tier, because I before this morning, I don't even think I could have told you who they are. I wouldn't have recognized the name. But I saw it says Bybit detected unauthorized activity involving one of our ETH cold wallets. The incident occurred when our ETH multisig cold wallet executed a transfer to our warm wallet. Unfortunately, this transaction was manipulated through a sophisticated attack that masked the signing interface, displaying the correct address while altering the underlying smart contract logic. As a result, the attacker was able to gain control of the affected ETH cold wallet and transfer its holdings to an unidentified address. So that's the setup, and that's the thing that everybody's kind of buzzing about. And I'm seeing like a lot of Bitcoiners come out and say, yeah, see, you know, that's what you get for messing with shitcoins and stuff. Or the attack surface area of ETH is too complicated to deal with. So, like, I'm hearing and seeing all that, and you know, some of it sounds like stuff that Bitcoin would be subject to similarly, right? Like an address replacement attack is not unique to ETH or Ethereum or this exchange Bybit. But I guess there's other stuff with like how smart contracts work that may just be like, it sounds good in principle, but it's actually very complicated and prevents the players who are trying to understand what they're signing from understanding that. So like, do you see this as like an exclusive to ETH type of problem, or is this more a general industry across the ecosystem type of problem that could occur? Will we expect to see this in Bitcoin? Is this just another reason to be off of exchanges, or sort of where does this news sit for you?
I mean, probably sprinkle in a little of everything you just said. I definitely, hacks like this are not just specific to Ethereum. Now the exact vulnerability and weakness, we kind of have some hints as to what it is, but we don't know. So there's certainly things that can be specific to a particular cryptocurrency or platform, but just hacks in general, you know, obviously can occur in Bitcoin land as well. So, I mean, one theme here is not your keys, not your coins. It's just yet another example in the long history of, hacks that should encourage people to want to take control of their coins. Now, I'm not super familiar with Bybit, but it seems like it's a trading platform. So even if you have your coins in self custody, if you're then trading, you might give them to a third party exchange. So that would, but that suggests using a DEX or ways to do a more advanced version of exchange. Bybit, I mean, you said maybe it's second or third tier. I admittedly had never, I maybe heard of it. I'm not familiar with it at all, but I think I read somewhere they're doing like $1 billion in profit. So not second tier from a financial income perspective, but you know, probably just part of the gambling crypto casino. But as far as this vulnerability, I mean, address replacement attack, that can occur on any cryptocurrency, including Bitcoin. In this particular case, you know, it sounds like it's an Ethereum smart contract. Maybe there's like, there's probably a larger attack surface possible on Ethereum than with Bitcoin. And so maybe that was exposed. Just in general, any custodian, they need to have super good operational security. And you know, one technique used by some is to generate a whitelist of destinations where funds can flow, like from cold storage to hot wallets. So it should be, in theory, impossible for it to go to a hacker.
How would you do that? You're saying like a whitelist. Is that something you would upload to your transaction coordinator software?
You'd put it in an enterprise HSM, like a secure enclave, and that in theory couldn't be updated, or you know, the update procedure to that HSM, very limited set of people. There could be even other processes that confirm whatever software is being run inside the HSM is like verifiable and hasn't been tampered with. So, I mean, nothing is perfect security, but if you take steps like this, you'd have a whitelist of destination addresses that any funds moving out of cold storage would have to go to those. It would be enforced by this HSM. And then an outside attacker wouldn't be, even there'd be, because in this case, it sounds like the user interface, whoever approved this transaction, what they are shown looked correct, but it actually wasn't really what was happening underneath. That wouldn't be possible with the HSM. So my guess is they did not have a sophisticated setup like that.
And HSM is, that's a special type of chip that lives on a signing device. Is that true?
I mean, it stands for like hardware secure module. I mean, there's other terms like TE, trusted execution environment. Intel SGX is an example. Amazon has Nitro. There's a little bit of variation between all these different things, but they, in general, are a class of computing where it makes it extremely difficult and costly to physically attack the chip. So even if you have direct physical access to the computer, you can't just like break into the chip and get out the data, get the secrets. It would cost at least millions of dollars to devise a physical attack to access what's inside, the contents inside the chip. And there's also a lot of protections so that like just random connected computers to the HSM can't upload new code, new data to modify the internal contents. There's a lot of protections around that.
But I assume there's some way to update the internal contents. Like it is both readable and writable by some.
Yes, unless you throw away the keys. So Apple makes great use of this technology. It's part of their end-to-end security, end-to-end encryption security, in fact, which is another topic I think we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And Apple has a very, very elaborate architecture, which they've done a pretty good job of publishing what their architecture is and what they do. My recollection of reading it is that they actually threw away the keys. They deleted the keys so that they cannot update the firmware code. It's still
this is for all of the firmware that's in any HSM or secure enclave in any Apple device. Like basically, nobody can write to that or change it.
Well, I'm referring. I mean, iPhones also have a secure enclave, but I'm referring to their cloud enterprise HSM. I don't know if their claim is for every HSM Apple runs, but at least the ones that pertain to the data that was discussed, I believe they delete the keys. Now, it's still a trust model. They're telling us they delete the keys.
Right.
Maybe they didn't delete the keys, or maybe they thought they deleted the keys, but they didn't properly delete the keys. So there's still trust involved. But you know, any security is just layer upon layer upon layer. So it's certainly better from a security standpoint if the data is inside an HSM. If they've thrown away the keys, then you know, then if they truly have properly deleted the keys, then there'd be no way to update that software. I guess, except for like if you have this elaborate multi-million-dollar attack where you physically unwind the semiconductor chip and are able to like manipulate it or something, then obviously you could change the data inside. But certainly,
this is access. This is a separate place that's accessed by the CPU whenever it needs to sign a transaction. Is that what's going on?
Yeah. Well, in the case, I mean, you know, obviously you can, there's many applications of this, but with respect to cryptocurrency and the topic at hand, you could, you'd have the private keys in the HSM, and then you would sign transactions in the HSM, but you'd also need, you need policy logic in the HSM, because if you don't have policy logic, then yes, maybe the private keys never exit the HSM, but right. If you're just told sign this transaction and you're blind, it's called blind signing, you don't know what you're signing, then you could be signing the good guy's transaction or the bad guy's transaction. So it's almost pointless. It's like security theater if it's blind signing. So you also need to have policy logic in the HSM that's tamper resistant. And that could include things like a whitelist of destination addresses. It can, you know, the policy can include many things, including like where should these funds go or not go. Velocity controls, like how fast can funds move.
But if you're putting this into that piece of silicon, do you need to know that before it leaves the factory? That can't be the case, right?
No, you can update the HSM. You can update the HSM, you can update the HSM, but then there's like, what do you do after that? I mean, how is this different from just a regular computer or CPU? Well, one, you'd have an access list to people who can update that HSM. Two is that it's a much more limited environment for updating than a regular computer. But you can also, as I mentioned, you can delete. You can delete the keys. And then another thing, I forget if I mentioned or not, but there's also the notion of like verifiable code and builds. So we've talked about reproducible builds before in the show. This can also apply to server side code in an HSM, which is pretty novel territory in computing in general, but it would allow the software that's running in the HSM to be, you know, published source. Anyone in the world could access it and, you know, build that software and then compare the binary they get in their independent build to the binary that's running in the HSM. And there'd be a cryptographic attestation that this is the actual binary that's running in the HSM. You'd be able to verify that externally in a cryptographic confident way that, yes, that is the binary that's running, and thus it was built from the software that I've independently, you know, audited and built.
So verifiable computing, kind of like reproducible builds for software that's running in memory? Is that kind of the analogy here?
I don't know if I would define it that way. Verifiable computing. I mean, I actually don't know what experts around this. Again, I'm not an expert in this stuff. I don't know what experts would, how they would define it. But I mean, at least the context I'm talking about is like server side, but also, you know, within a secure enclave.
One way to think about in memory.
Like, I guess I didn't understand the, you know, in memory part, because like, whether it's in an HSM or not an HSM or server or phone, or I mean, like, if application's running, it's going to have memory. So, I mean, what would be the opposite of?
I guess, like, I was thinking something runtime, whether it's in memory or in CPU or being read off of a storage, a part, you know, to be paged in as part of like a running operation. I guess trying to understand, am I running the actual software I think I am versus reproducible builds? My understanding is kind of like statically, like, did I download the right software? And like, am I downloading the right software versus am I running the right software? But they're kind of each trying to get at the answer to that. Is that the case?
I think in both cases, like, I mean, here's the software program, the code. I have the code. I do a build. How do I know that that is what's running on a device, whether it's a phone, my laptop, or someone else's server?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same concept. The only difference is, like, if it's on my phone or my laptop, I have physical access to it. I'm holding it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, setting aside, I mean, if I like disconnect from the internet, then I am fully in control of what software is running on this computer, and I can verify that the software I'm running matches this independent thing I've built. Whereas if it's on a computer I do not have access to, it's physically somewhere else in the cloud, someone's data center. All this is just saying is, like, I can still gain that confidence that it's running the software just like on my phone or laptop, even if I'm not physically present with it through cryptographic attestation.
I see. So it's cryptographic attestation that this code is being run and that it's operating the way you expect it to, even if you're not in control of the thing that's operating it. Whereas reproducible build is like, does this static piece of binary data match this piece of binary data, more or less?
Yeah.
Cool. On the address replacement stuff, I think it's kind of interesting, you know, that was what happened in the exploit. You know, I think this can happen, you know, even somebody who thinks they know what they're doing, this could happen just when you're copying and pasting, right? If you copy on your computer and you paste, you might have malware running on your computer that pastes a different thing than what you copied, right? So that's one reason that people often, I think, choose to use hardware signers with displays so that they can review the address that the hardware signer believes that it's sending to. Is that right?
Yeah.
And I think we've talked before that BitKey doesn't have a display, but that there's some people who have concerns about that, but that my understanding is you think that's probably fine, but is that, yeah, can you tell me more about that? Like, does BitKey not require such a display because there's another way to verify the address that you're sending to?
There's not currently another way. So, let's see. So other products have a display so that any transaction that it's signing for any output to that transaction that are going to addresses that the wallet itself cannot sign for, it would show on the display. And then you can compare that to wherever you think you're sending it to make sure it matches. Even that's not bulletproof for a couple reasons. One is that whatever it is you're comparing it to, if it also has been replaced,
mm-hmm.
then you're comparing two things, they match, you think you're good, but they both were the attacker's address. So for example, let's say I was sending funds to Coinbase to do a trade, and I'm on Coinbase's website. In my web browser, it shows an address, and then I look at my hardware display and it matches that address, and I think I'm good. Well, what if the attacker modified my web page and mm-hmm. you know, injection attacks in a web browser are well-known attack vectors, and it's certainly a vulnerable area. If, you know, then my hardware display didn't help me at all. I would be sending the funds to an attacker. So it's not like hardware displays are foolproof, but they do protect against the case where the wallet software, be it on your laptop or your phone, is showing you the destination address, which is correct. Or let's say I'm sending you funds and you sent them to me over a, you know, an end-to-end encrypted messaging app like Signal or something, or you give me a piece of paper with the address, and I'm highly confident that is the correct address, then I can look at the hardware display and be much more confident it's going to the right address. So it definitely has its place in security and has benefits as well. you know,
it almost sounds like just moving out of band in some way. Like if you had in your original example, if you were looking at an address on Coinbase, if you logged into it with a different computer, then it would be harder to do that kind of malicious code. So it kind of like, do you have two channels in some form or another?
Agreed. Because then you have like two hardware stacks, software stacks, like two like separate, independent, difficult attacks, which makes it exponentially harder to attack. Agreed. The other challenge with hardware displays, I think from a usability standpoint, is just like, do users even appreciate how important this is?
Mm-hmm.
And then two, even if they appreciate it, over time, do they get lazy? Right. So some people maybe never get educated and actually they don't even understand how important it is. So even though they have a hardware display, they don't check it. So they mm-hmm. be vulnerable. Then there's a set of people who do get educated, appreciate the importance of it, but then like, you know, they do transactions maybe, you know, very, very infrequently. And like a few years later, they forget, or they get lazy, or they think, what are the odds? And they don't check the display, and then they would suffer an attack. So, but having said that, you know, I mean, you asked about BitKey. Like one solution that's been published by that team that hasn't been implemented yet, but is still possible part of the roadmap. They called it server as a screen, and it would be where you get transaction verification, like you just said, actually out of band. So it could be sent from the BitKey server over email or over a text message, or it could be over any medium, and you could view it on a separate device other than your phone, and it would show you, here's the destination addresses, the amount.
Oh, that's cool.
There's benefits to that solution over hardware display, because most hardware devices displays are quite tiny. So you can't even, like, there's literally not even enough physical space to show the address. It has to like scroll by, making it difficult usability. And there's certainly not enough information on that display to like give you context as to like, why are you even doing this? What the motivating the person of the importance. But obviously in an email or an entire screen, like, I mean, sort of a virtual screen, you have as much room as you want. So you can deliver a much better UX that way. And if it's done on out of band through a different computer, even if, you know, your laptop in a web browser is a more vulnerable environment than a hardware device, attacking both of that and your mobile phone is a tall order, right? So it's generally pretty secure. However, if that solution comes to be, the customer needs to, again, appreciate the importance of this and understand that it's extra secure to view it on a separate device other than their phone. Because this attack only comes to be is if your phone is attacked with malware that can actually impact private key signing or address replacement attack on your phone.
But I guess at least in the case of like an iOS device, I think they're relatively well sandboxed between apps. So if you had like one BitKey app that were somehow, you know, got, you know, somebody somehow were able to compromise that, it wouldn't necessarily compromise the Safari app or some other web browser that same device had, right?
That's my intuition. I did ask a few security experts about this specifically. They actually disagreed. First of all, the type of attack on a phone to be able to even compromise a mobile wallet in this way is a very sophisticated attack. Cost multiple millions of dollars to buy such an attack, and then once you use that vulnerability, it gets fixed right away by Apple or whoever, and then you can't use it anymore. So these are not like trivial attacks. But if you do actually have if you spend multiple millions of dollars on this type of attack, you acquire it and then you deploy it and target people, the security researchers and experts that I spoke to actually thought that type of attack, that the incremental barrier to also attack iMessage or your Gmail app would be small. So like if you spent the millions of dollars of this attack, you'd also make sure to attack the other mechanisms.
And do everything all at once.
Yeah.
And do you think that is the iOS, I guess we have this other topic to discuss around iOS and privacy, but is the iOS overall security model still considered much better for managing kind of those types of threats or sort of being defensive against those types of vulnerabilities compared to say like an Android ecosystem app or OS?
I think that's always been our impression. I think that's still generally true that Android's a little bit more Wild West, but I think for both mobile platforms, it's a pretty high bar to pull off big attacks like this.
Yeah, and these are mostly, when you say like the multi-million dollars, those are like you're buying a 0 day at one of those.
Like what nation states do to, like Pegasus and things like that.
What is Pegasus?
I don't know. Is that a
famous attack or that's like a hacker group?
Yeah, like if a government wants to go after dissidents or something and, be able to see all of a person's communication on their phone,
mm-hmm.
they spend millions of dollars on that.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's actually a pretty good segue to this other topic that I think this also just came out this morning, right? Is that UK, I'm going to pull up the thing. It says Apple pulls data protection tool after UK government security row. And it says Apple's taking the unprecedented step of removing its highest level data security tool from customers in the UK after the government demanded access to user data. And later on in the article that we're reading, this from the BBC, said it is not known how many people have signed up for ADP, which is the service that is getting disabled, since it became available to British Apple customers in 2022. And what did the UK ask for? The request was served by the Home Office under the Investigatory Powers Act, IPA, which compels firms to provide information to law enforcement agencies. And it sounds like Apple will not comment on the specifics of the notice. Can you talk through a little bit about like, what is this all about? What are we learning here? Is your microphone? It looks like your microphone may. Oh, sorry, it's okay. What are we learning here?
I'm trying to look at if there's any audience questions.
Oh, and if there is, let us know.
So I mute because then it starts.
Okay,
giving feedback.
Right.
Of you talking. Okay.
Got it. Sorry, I thought I may have lost you, but yeah. So my understanding is. In the UK, there's this ADP, is this advanced data protection service that's available worldwide, but it prevents governments from being able to investigate or see what's going on in your communication or other activities on the device. And so, UK is forcing Apple to remove that level of privacy so a user in the UK can't have that level of privacy. Is that kind of the broad strokes what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, the UK demanded that Apple add a backdoor to get this data. I mean, there was a case, a decade ago, where the FBI had apprehended a suspect, had their iPhone, demanded...
This was the Santa Barbara thing, right?
Yeah.
It was like a shooter. Yes.
And then demanded that Apple literally modify like iOS code to backdoor it. Apple refused. And it would have been a really interesting court case with precedent set. But then I think the FBI figured out another way. Or they basically stopped harassing Apple because they found a different path. But it sounds... similar, right? I don't know whether there's like a specific case the UK is trying where they're or if it's just like an overall policy perspective. I don't know why they're pushing what the motivation is, but I actually don't even know the details. Like, I mean, in terms of the demand to Apple, is this like a regulatory body or like what? I have no idea. But anyway, Apple was faced with a decision to either comply and add a backdoor, remove the feature from their products for UK customers, or just ignore the government and be illegal. And they chose to remove the feature from UK for UK customers.
And it sounds like regrettably, right? Like they said, we regret that we have to do this.
I think it's definitely regrettable.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't add this feature because they didn't think it was important for their customers, for their brand, for their product. I mean, Apple does do, I really admire Apple for how much investment they've done on privacy in their products. Mm-hmm. Given that they're like the king.
Yeah.
Usually when you're the king and you like dominate, something like privacy is easy to deprioritize or just never, even if you care, even if you actually personally care about it.
Yeah.
It's so easy to deprioritize in products because most customers don't care. It's not super marketable.
Mm-hmm.
For mainstream products. It historically has not been very marketable. They've chosen to invest serious engineering chops and technology to create a really robust foundation. And then they also spend tons of money marketing it as well. I would love to be a fly on the wall inside Apple to understand what was their motivation, especially for the marketing dollars. Because there's one thing to like invest in privacy to make sure your products have it, but you don't market it because you decide, well, it's not marketable, but we want to be responsible for our customers. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that when our customers do care, which might be 10 years from now, that they'll look back and be like, you know, Apple or whoever the product, they had our back. That product and that brand had our back. I love them even more, right? But you don't have to market it. But they chose to market it, and I would guess they spent billions of dollars marketing privacy. So why did they do that? My guess is that they did it because they've been doing it for like 5 or 10 years now, I think. But
yeah,
they perceived like Facebook and Google as two of their biggest competitive threats. And, you know, certainly in the 5 to 10 year ago era, that was true and maybe a little less now, but like, and then, you know, and they, their competitive analysis of Google and Facebook is like, these are advertising based businesses that need user data. And our business is not advertising driven. So, you know, it's like a gotcha moment.
It's sort of like, sort of counterpositioning, right? They're saying like, you guys can't make these claims. We can. And so we're going to make them so strong that it forces you into a weird position.
So I would definitely bet that was part of their calculus. Was that the primary and motivating factor? I don't know. I would also die to know how effective their marketing has been. And like, does their customer base actually care about that? Has it been impactful? As a privacy fan myself, I hope the answer is yes. I'm kind of skeptical, to be honest, though. I still think mainstream Americans and just mainstream Europeans and just mainstream people, humans, generally haven't faced pain in their life due to all these like privacy data honeypots that are like all over the world. And there's going to come a reckoning. But we really haven't... Even America, like there's been so many hacks, like all the, like the, there's two or three businesses that collect all our identity information and then they've all been hacked. And I mean, the government, the US government's been hacked, tons of different departments, tons of companies have been hacked. You know, bring this back to like cryptocurrency and stuff, like Ledger had a huge hack of their customer database. I was included in that, and you know, I was naive at the time when I first bought a Ledger. I just added my name and address, home address, and bought a product just like I buy any other product. And that's how most people are going to buy a product. But well, guess what? It wound up in a database that thieves intentionally targeted because they knew that was a list of crypto people. And then boom, now they have like email, and phone and home address. So, ever since that day, almost every day I get a phishing attack over email and text. I'm like super desensitized to that now, but I'm sure lots of people fall victim to it. Those attacks are getting more and more sophisticated too. I worry about the day when I'm, even though I'm like super paranoid, when I'm tricked. And then the home address leak is super, super concerning as well. Even though I think that the probability of a $5 rent attack or a physical attack at your home is orders of magnitude lower than an online attack, because an online attack, you can be in any remote region of the world and attack lots of people. It's way cheaper, way less risk. Just the fear of being vulnerable, having your home address and your family exposed that way is super, affects your psychology. So anyway.
Do you think privacy is likely to become a more mainstream issue over the next 5 or 10 years? Like, do you think we're kind of where we are, or will there be forces in the world that cause this to become more of a mainstream issue, you think?
I think it'll become more mainstream. I'm not super confident in that, though. But unfortunately, I think it's a function of pain. Like, privacy is the kind of thing, like, if you don't feel pain in your life, just like I said, like, product teams generally don't prioritize it because they're not feeling pain. Their customers aren't saying, we're not going to use or buy your product unless you fix privacy. So they don't do it. Well, and any individual in their life, if they're not feeling pain, like, there's been all these thefts of data about us, like, it's well documented, us meaning, like, you know, lots of people, but like certainly Americans,
citizens,
like tons of Americans have had lots of their data stolen. But there's definitely identity theft is an issue, and that causes people kind of annoyance pain, high annoyance. Mm-hmm. So I think that helps educate people on like the importance of privacy, but that alone hasn't been enough, I don't think. So I think the more pain people feel in their lives, and certainly if it's like physical threats or whatever, that changes behavior. So sadly, like, so if that occurs, then yes, I think it'll become more mainstream. But if it's more just like proactive, let's course correct, I'm a little more skeptical there.
I wonder if one of the types of pains that we might see emerge, you know, in the next years. Like, I would say, sort of to back it up, I don't feel like I was super sensitive to privacy stuff, especially online privacy, maybe 20, 25 years ago. And I think over time, it's kind of been a steady progression of like more concern, asking more questions, learning more about it, to the point that now, you know, you could maybe say I'm like kind of, you know, on the more paranoid side of things, or maybe more cautious of a generous framing of it. But like, I mean, I remember even, you know, maybe it was 10 years ago, I was like, you know, what's the big deal? iMessage, what am I saying that's going to cause a problem anyway? You know, just sort of like, doesn't feel like there's an imminent threat to, you know, somebody seeing my iMessages. But I do think that with the emergence of LLMs and sort of, you know, the kinds of power that type of tool gives to a government that may be on your side, may not be on your side. Who knows who's running the government, you know, today versus 4 years from now. And there's just so much uncertainty and so many powerful tools that can be in the hands of the few. And so you start to, I think, see that, hey, like if my communication, like it's not that my communication looks problematic or exposed, but I see other people who I could assess it as, you know, now that it's been revealed, I can assess that it doesn't look super problematic. But somehow this LLM discovered that there was something that felt a little off that caused them to get, I don't know, thrown in jail or fined, or, you know, maybe we end up with a, you know, social credit score of some form. And not that I'm hoping for it, I hope we don't, but I feel like there's a lot of tools that are getting into the hands of people that could enable such things, which makes me more, aware of it. And it might actually become more, you know, more headlines, more news stories, more people trying to manage cryptocurrency or kind of manage their communications and not be subject to things that they think are kind of unfair.
Yep. Yeah, I do think AI, big data, just all that can just accelerate things. And give more power to a small group of people to do bad things. And that could be physical or economical harm to people. Based on information about you, whether it be, messages you send to people. I mean, there's one thing if it's like public posts. I mean, there can be like public social media posts you do, and all that can be like analyzed and sort of summarize who you are, give you some kind of social credit score. Then there's like more private data as well. And if that gets hoovered up, that can lead to you being temporarily banned from certain services, or permanently yep. banned, getting criminally prosecuted, thrown in jail.
I'm not going to dox our friend, but I'll mention that we had a friend who recently applied for a role and was denied that role, and we're not sure why, because he's actually probably overqualified for it. But we, I mean that seriously. When we heard that he was denied that role, I actually decided to ask. I went to Twitter, and Twitter has a service called Grok 3, which is kind of this new LLM that's launched. And I asked it to analyze his tweets and tell me stuff about his biases or political leanings or the reasons that he may be denied such an opportunity. And it came back with things that I would say, somebody who's assessing his fit for a role might say, this is not actually a good fit. Not on our team, not one of us.
Yep. So that's a great example of a tool. Like old school Web 2 type people search things. So like you go to LinkedIn and you go to Google and LinkedIn and search for a person's name and see their resume and maybe a few things on the web. But yeah, the example you did in Grok 3, like a few two, three, four paragraphs, whatever, really. I mean, as I mentioned, I learned things about him and he's one of my best friends. So,
pretty
wild.
We could go to LinkedIn. It's hard to digest. You sort of get the person puts forth the view that they want to put forth of themselves, but you don't really get the full picture of everything that can be known about them based on what's online. Whereas with LLMs like Grok 3, you actually get really fast processing of huge amounts of data that I couldn't scour it myself, or it would take too long. I'd have to invest weeks and weeks in doing it. Now I can do it in about 30 seconds. Yep. So if I have that as just some regular citizen, now you take a government that has access to backdoors or has access to various things. You could imagine people being denied opportunities for things that in kind of like historical, the recent several decades would just seem like obvious. It seems like nonsense that somebody would be denied such a thing.
Yep. And obviously there can be errors here. I mean, first of all, the summary, the AI, the summary, the model, even as good as it's getting, it still doesn't know all the context behind the posts of what the person is thinking and what the person's behavior has been, their actions.
How much of a troll are they? Like they might just be like shit posting or kidding sometimes, and the AI might not understand that.
Tons of context that would be needed. But another thing that is important, I mentioned like private data sources. So like, getting back to the Apple and UK decision, what alarms me is any kind of government encroachment on end-to-end encryption, and like the ability to have messaging apps, as an example, like between you and me, being able to send a message back and forth and not have the government have access to that information. To me, that's like should be fundamental right. Because I think most people would agree if the two of us are physically in a room together. Like if we're physically in my house, I think most people would agree the government shouldn't be spying in my house, recording our conversation, putting it in a database, and then using that, some future administration using that data to judge us a year from now, 10 years.
Only
from now,
Amazon Alexa is allowed.
Most people would be like, most people would be like, that's absurd. But it seems to me like people are less sensitive to the government if I, instead of speaking something to you or writing it on a note and handing it to you, but instead I write it on my phone and send it to you, they're less sensitive to that just because it like makes its way over the internet or something. I don't understand that at all. Like to me, the from a policy standpoint and like what we want out of society, there's no difference between the two. It's private communication between you and me, not intended for the public, not intended for the government, and it should be protected. And I'm sure that's what Apple, Apple's belief is too, and that's why they have end-to-end encryption. And so it's just really disappointing to see the UK want to insert backdoors and people to gain access to that. So like, let me say that something extreme, or people think it's extreme, but I think it's just a natural thought exercise. I mean, where do you draw the line in terms of what the government has access to? If they have access to data on your phone, like is the data and information on the phone, like my own notes or thoughts or whatever, is that mine and not theirs, or do they have access to it? What about when we have Neuralink or some kind of like brain thing? Like when the technology allows it.
Yeah, it gets scary.
Should the government have access to what's going on in our minds? You know, there's going to come a time when the technology allows for that. Most people would be like, of course not. Like first of all, that's absurd. That'll never happen. But most people would be like, of course they shouldn't have access. Well, then why should they have access to what's on our phone? And there's been recent examples of where there's incursion on the phone as well. And Apple, despite having a great privacy track record, fumbled the ball on this a few years ago, in which they agreed to let the government get access to photos on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Under the auspices of combating child porn. So a topic that there's near universal agreement is super bad, and we want to exercise all tools to combat that because it's so awful for society. But it opens, from a policy perspective, it opens up Pandora's box, because then what's the next bad thing? Right. That a government thinks, and the next bad thing. Once you have that tool, then the government's going to keep adding bad things to the list. Then you start getting into situations where a lot of people don't think it's a bad thing, and then yet they have access to all your photos in your phone, and iMessage as well. And again, then what about when it's in your head? I mean, like, so I think there needs to be a lot more discussions about this in society, and I find it very alarming that governments are doing this. Especially like in Great Britain and in Europe, they claim to be so privacy sensitive with like GDPR and created policies that have just ruined the web to try to protect people's privacy. And yet they enact things like this, which are clearly horrible for citizen privacy.
So I'm not going to take this position, but imagine that I could imagine somebody in my family who I describe this kind of threat to or kind of worry, and they would say like, hey, I don't really have anything to hide. I'm kind of all above board and friendly, and everything's fine. So why should I care? How would you respond to that?
I think that's a super common thought that people have. I've heard that from family members myself, because most people are law-abiding people, ethical people who live a good life, and they believe that, and so they think they have nothing to hide. But if you think about like conversations you have with your buddies in your home, in private context, often you'll have jokes, you'll have, you know, make flippant remarks, you'll take shortcuts in the language you use to be expedient.
Yeah.
Whereas if you were to like say that on national news, or you knew that the quote was going to be in the front page of the New York Times or something, you would like more carefully construct the words, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if all this casual, loose, comical, distasteful joke language all gets hoovered up and it becomes part of your profile, it can create an image that you didn't intend for certain audiences to ever see. And that doesn't make you a bad person. That's just human. And we all have a range of things we think and say and alter it based on the context. So I'd say that's one response I would have. Maybe it's more common to hear that from an American, but like it really depends on which country you're from, the history of that country, and how the government operates in a country can like dramatically change one's answer to that as well.
Right. And my understanding from UK in particular, because that's sort of where the news is on this Apple stuff, is that I don't know a lot about UK government, but my understanding is it's not meant, I don't know, it's not structured. It doesn't claim to be a free society in the way that maybe the US does. Do you know anything about how they think about freedom or kind of self-sovereignty?
No, sorry, British citizens or the government? Or I don't have the answer to either.
I guess either, because I thought I was listening to some, maybe it was a Peter McCormick thing, because he's based in UK. And I thought that he had said something about, we don't even pretend to be a democracy. We don't even pretend to have many freedoms. That maybe it's kind of like the citizenry accepts that it's just, it is what it is. And the government controls a lot of stuff and kind of, you know, invades privacy a lot.
I mean, you know, so like CCTV, like just cameras. I mean, it is an interesting, there's more and more incursions on privacy, but it's not like just completely idiotic. I mean, like, cameras are all over the place now, and they're often used in criminal investigations, and they often catch the bad guy. So in those individual instances, that's a positive if society can catch the bad guy and punish the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of people, I mean, it's undeniable that it could be a useful tool as well. So a lot of citizens just see that as a useful tool. I mean, it's similar to like AML laws.
Mm-hmm.
They can be used to catch criminals, catch the bad guy. So that in isolation, that's a good thing. You know, but the broader picture is how effective are those at catching criminal behavior? And then what are the hidden costs? I don't think the costs are always accounted for. So
I think nobody talks about the costs.
Yeah, so that's why I find it disingenuous public policy discussion, because I don't think it's looking at the big picture. It's and then same with privacy. Like, got to look at the bigger all facets of it, not just one side.
Mm-hmm. All right, cool. Should we move on? We've got a few other topics that we'd sort of teed up here. If we could move to this, how about this Amboss. Okay. Amboss tweet says, Lightning payment reliability for $100 payments has been launched higher by Bitcoin's price increase. $100 of BTC can now be sent anywhere in the Lightning network with a 77% chance of success, 20% from last year. And I looked at this and I wasn't quite sure what it meant. So I wonder if there's something more about what we're looking at here that you could describe. And obviously, I'll pop it back. It's just us, but...
Well, also, what, you should know Amboss, because their CEO is one of our listeners. Jesse.
Oh, great.
And Max is an investor, I believe, in Amboss.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So that's the kind of... But I wanted to mention this because the data shown there's different ways to measure and calculate it, and there's different interpretations. And I saw a lot of responses to that tweet making fun of Lightning and laughing at it that, you know, because let's be real, 77% payment success rate is not good, right? And imagine if every time you went to use your credit card or whatever, your Apple Pay or a $20 bill, if a quarter of the time it didn't work,
right?
That people would not accept that, right?
And the marketing messages. Good news. It usually works.
Yes. You need 99% plus, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
And just to make sure I understand what we're saying, when it doesn't work, it's like, I have a valid wallet. You have a valid destination address. I try to send, you know, Lightning to that address. And there's like, it just says it fails. And maybe it couldn't find a route or something like that.
Find a route is the common reason. Because Lightning requires liquidity. In the path between you and me, it requires liquidity in that path, and it couldn't find enough, which is why the higher the payment amount, you would naturally expect the payment success rate to decline, because it requires more liquidity, because it's a higher payment amount.
Mm-hmm.
If you just quickly read that tweet, see 77% payment success, obviously the takeaway would be like, Lightning sucks. But it's a little more nuanced than that, or a lot more nuanced. for two reasons. One, the data being used there is from a simulation and not the actual network. I think they use some data from the real world, but it's largely a simulation. So that just, and not that that disqualifies it being interesting, but that should be known. But the most important difference is that a high quality, or first of all, high quality wallets with Lightning are seeing success rates on the order of 99% or higher. So actual Lightning users' experiences are on the 99% range, not 77%. So it just doesn't match reality.
Okay.
That's the number one takeaway. And why is that? Well, high quality wallets score the network. They're building up data over time to score the network and know which paths are better for liquidity. So an important technical detail, the Lightning Network, for privacy reasons, nodes don't publicly advertise, here's our the channel balance for each channel. They don't advertise that. So it's unknown. So you can't just like hoover in all the public data on Lightning and know in real time where all the liquidity is. You only know the channel capacity.
And channel capacity is a multi-hop process, right?
No. Let's just say you and I have a channel. Mm-hmm. And let's say we open a channel that has 0.1 Bitcoin. That's the capacity. But over time, the Bitcoin shifts. It's like an abacus. It shifts back and forth between you and me. It's that balance on either side that is not public information. And it's not known in real time by wallets. It can be estimated though. So wallets do use probing techniques and just through their own sending and receiving payments, they learn information to score different nodes and have a more intelligent view of the network so that they can be smarter about which routes to pick. And also a wallet can try multiple routes all in the background. The user doesn't even know it. But if I'm trying to send you money, it might try route A, fail, then try route B, fail, then route C, it works. That's all done within like 2 or 3 seconds. Like we don't even know that's happening.
Right.
All we see is payment success. So the user view is like, it was a successful payment, even though it was a 33% success rate.
I see.
So that's one thing. You can actually have 77% success rate, but from the user perspective is 100%. But the most important point is that good wallets will score the network, and the AMBOSS technique was randomly selected nodes.
Mm-hmm. So they weren't scoring it. They weren't trying to find the good routes.
And several years ago, another Max investment, Umbrel, created a popular Raspberry Pi product, which came bundled with a bunch of Bitcoin goodies and like an LND node and Lightning node. And so a lot of people bought those. They just made it easy to plug in, have a Bitcoin core node running, having a Lightning node running, and easily add a channel. So a lot of people, thousands of people, maybe tens of thousands of people did that. But I believe many of them then just didn't touch it again. Mm-hmm. So there's a ton of nodes in the Lightning Network that are hobbyists who don't pay attention, don't manage liquidity, and they aren't high quality nodes to route payments through because they're not actively being managed. So if in your data measurement you include those, then you're going to get bad results. But any high quality wallet is going to score and learn to avoid those nodes and never route through them. So
do you think the AMBOSS chart that we looked at, or kind of that tweet, is it celebrating something where the news is actually better than what it's celebrating, or it's celebrating it for the wrong reason, or what?
No, people's takeaway is that Lightning sucks. 77% success rate sucks. What I'm saying is that that's not true. Again, what good wallets see is 99% success rate because of the reason that I just said.
Right.
They score the network, they pick better routes, they avoid these bad nodes. And then there are these bad nodes for the reasons I said. I mean, it's easy to take the wrong takeaway from that. So I'm just trying to clarify that. Now, I think what I talked to Jesse and I about it, and I think what they're trying to communicate, and I agree with, is that he just wants to see the Lightning Network improve overall. Like, we don't want just a few hubs that are good and everything routes through a few hubs that's very centralized. So we want, you know, as many nodes in the network as possible and as many of those nodes that are on network to be well managed and good liquidity. And I think, you know, Amboss has products to help you manage the liquidity. So like, they're also, they're trying to sell their service. So that's great, you know? So there's nothing wrong with highlighting that, hey, some nodes in the network can do a better job. Here's some tools to improve that. That's good for Bitcoin, and it's good for service providers trying to sell that. It's just important to know that it's not the complete story.
Yeah. I guess also, as I'm looking at it, and I'm, you know, more of an outsider with respect to Lightning than either you or Jesse, but when I look at that, it sounds like they're saying as the price of Bitcoin has risen, that the $100 is getting better routes, or kind of, how it's phrased exactly. $100 of BTC can now be sent anywhere in Lightning Network with a 77% chance of success. And like you said, maybe that's actually closer to 100% if you try a couple times. But just because if the price of Bitcoin is increasing and the $100 is a lower fraction of that, then actually maybe has more routes to get where it needs to go because it's a smaller amount. There's more liquidity that is available at
there
the $100.
There would be more liquidity. I mean, if you hold constant how much Bitcoin is there, and then if like what most people are paying for is denominated in dollars, then you would, you know, a year ago, I paid $100 for something. Today, I pay $100, but I'm actually sending a smaller amount of Bitcoin over the network. Yeah. So it would require less of the available liquidity.
Right. So to me, that kind of sounds like part of what, at least how I'm reading the tweet, what is kind of being celebrated is just as the price goes up, and which I think maybe there's a bigger takeaway there is if the price continues to go up, then the $100 transaction will find more liquidity if the Bitcoin within these channels is kind of, you know, thick.
Yeah.
Which obviously is not, but like, you know.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good point. I mean, that's an important point. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when we were just talking about this a moment ago, you were talking about how, you know, I'm going to mess it up. You know how much, what do you know about the PEZ? Something's known and something's not known. You know how much liquidity there is.
Yeah. You know, again, like let's say we you and I have a channel, Lightning channel between us, our software, our Lightning nodes, the capacity might be 0.1 Bitcoin, 10 million sats. That's the capacity that is publicly known. That's announced in gossip and every node. It's just public information. If you're any Lightning node listens to gossip, gets all this information about all the nodes, all the publicly announced nodes on the network, including capacity and all the channel data. But what's not gossiped is that in this instant in time, I have, you know, 4 million sats on my side and you have 6 million on your side. And of course that
can, so you know the total, but you don't know where the epic is.
Very quickly, right? I mean, like literally like every second that could keep updating. So it's not like every Lightning node of the network has that information. That's both a privacy reason, but also even like a data reason, right? I mean, like you'd have to broadcast that data in real time would be insane to every network. So they don't know. So your Lightning wallet and that node behind the Lightning wallet does not have the channel balances of every node in the network, every channel of the network. So you know that to get from you to me, there's like five different routes or whatever, like through different other nodes, but you don't know in real time which have liquidity in the correct direction and the amounts.
But that would be something if, let's say, Lightning had lots of use cases and were very successful and growing really fast, you would imagine that some players would emerge at some point in that growth where they would want more transactions to flow through them if they collect fees on each one. And so would there not be a way to broadcast not only this is how much capacity I have and liquidity I have, but this is actually, I'm set up to handle that next transaction you want to send, so send it my way so I get to collect fees?
That's a great question. And it gets to the heart of a like disagreement, or because I think if Jesse were on the show from Amboss, I think that, you know, Amboss collects a lot of data about Lightning nodes, and like Lightning node operators will often give the data to Amboss because it helps promote their Lightning node. So that's the motivation by both the Lightning node operator and Amboss in the business. Now, the concern is privacy. You're giving up data about your node and your wallet. And also when you have a centralized entity with all that data, that becomes kind of a nightmare as well. So there's definitely tension there and a trade-off.
But I guess I was imagining maybe there's a different type of a liquidity provider, wallet, node runner, the Lightning node runner, who would not really value privacy and is kind of doing it more for commercial interests. Maybe I, as a Lightning node runner with my own wallet, wouldn't want to broadcast that or kind of advertise that I'm a good route to go through, but that maybe if you were doing it for commercial reasons.
Right. But I think there's privacy erosion. Even if, you know, you choose not to do that, if everyone around you does do it, then it outs you, right?
Right.
So there's that concern. Another related thing, a new developer on Spiral, his name's Yost Jaeger. He's actually been involved in Lightning protocol development for many years. He recently, as in like the past week or so, proposed high availability Lightning nodes, in which there would be some kind of announcement and like get soft guarantee by a node that they'll guarantee to like almost reserve a certain amount of inbound or outbound capacity for one of their peers, in order to attract, I mean, ultimately create higher quality payment success rate, but also attract like, you know, peer with me because I'll give you guarantees. And these are not like cryptographic guarantees, they're not guarantees right. within the protocol, but you know, but that's also contentious. You know, Matt on our team doesn't like it at all. So I think this is an interesting area of discussion because there is, it's not cut and dried. I mean, it's not like you can easily make the case, like clearly we should choose option, the path A versus path B. It's because each path has trade-off.
Right. I see. And on, you mentioned briefly in that bit we were talking, you mentioned gossip, and I feel like I hear this in a bunch of contexts. I hear it on Noster. I think there's actually a client called Gossip Client. Is this something that's, I just hear about it in a bunch of contexts, but I don't know much about it. Is there part of the Lightning protocol that has its own gossip, and is there like a messaging channel that can use within the Lightning?
Yeah, I'm certainly not a peer-to-peer expert, but it's related to peer-to-peer protocols. Because like if you don't have a client server, I mean, most of us, even software engineers, are just used to client server architectures, in which there's just a lot of simplicity in that, because you know, the client connects to a server and the server sort of is the boss, and like the server has the data, the server controls things, and says, you know, it's a very clear relationship. Peer to peer, there's no boss. Like I just connect to other people just like me.
Yeah.
So how do I make requests? How do I get data? How do I learn about things? How do I even learn to like who to peer with? So the notion of gossip is just information that is publicly broadcast by every peer, saying like, here's information about here's the information we know, like this peer, here's what I know about the network, and just publish it to everyone. And that's how the network learns about other nodes, who to connect to, stuff like that. So it applies to the Bitcoin protocol, and it applies to the Lightning protocol as well.
This feels to me a lot like I think of the DNS analogy a lot, because a lot of like, how do you find routes through the internet is kind of similar. I mean, there's different trade-offs, obviously. But each, you know, there's like routing tables to say like, hey, I know the next hop, right? Is part of how DNS and routing tables work. So are those analogies often used within the Lightning discussions to think through sort of just like how stuff gets routed through the internet versus how it would get routed through Lightning? Or are they just like, there's not that much to learn. It's already kind of well known.
That's a good question. I don't really know. The Lightning gossip protocol was designed way back in like, it was before my time. So, back in like 2016, 2017 time period, it has a number of like areas of improvement, let's say, and it hasn't been improved yet. There's been, what I have been a part of the past several years in meetings with Lightning protocol developers, there's a number of ideas to improve that, the gossip protocol, some of which are underway, some of which are still more R&D. But in none of those contexts, I've really heard relationships to IP tables. But having said that, Rusty Russell, who's one of the premier Lightning protocol developers, I believe he like was a co-inventor of like IP tables in TCP/IP protocol. Yeah, so I have to believe that it was, that some of that old internet history is part of Lightning, just given him being part of both.
Yeah. And when you talk about gossip protocols being required for peer-to-peer systems that kind of naturally emerge, I'm also curious, is there already, when a new one emerges, is it usually kind of specifics of the protocol? Or like when I think about Nostr is kind of like a generalized public messaging system. And I wonder if Nostr is an interesting, way to do gossip for future protocols that get invented, or is it better for the gossip to be kind of closer to like running on the Lightning node or something like that?
Yeah, good question. I don't really have any. I don't know. I don't have any thoughts on that.
But does the Lightning one itself run, like when you run a Lightning node on your node, it's broadcasting these, all this gossip information, and so other people discover the node and start pulling it down and try to assemble their own picture of the network.
Yeah,
from them. Cool. Let's see. I've got a few more things, and we're 15 minutes left, and I've got a few more things on our list. Do you want to talk? Oh, go ahead.
I think we can tackle both the forking guide and
forking
the
guide?
Green Core Retro.
Yeah. I'll pull up the Bitcoin forking guide. So I was reading this one you sent this morning on delvingbitcoin.org. And it was somebody who appreciates the perspective that the BCAP project is offering. But then it kind of a question of how do you actually do this? How do you actually make a change happen? And, I read through it a little bit, and this is sort of the thing that he links to at the top. And I like this idea of consensus before consensus, because I think a lot of times people think, especially in very technical projects, they're thinking about, let me like write a prototype and I'll show how it works. And then everybody will obviously buy into my idea because it's like so awesome how I built it. And I think this one's saying like, before you get into that phase of things, take a step back and build consensus with the people that you want to appreciate it, get their feedback, try to build that consensus before you try to build the implementation of the consensus. But anyway, that's what I got kind of as a setup on it, but would love to hear kind of what you were thinking when you shared it.
Yeah. So AJ Towns, a longtime Bitcoin protocol developer, put that together. As he said, I mean, he was a reviewer of the BCAP project, which we've talked about a little bit in the show. We've never really gone deep on it, but that's the Bitcoin consensus analysis project that that I helped put together last year with a few others. And as AJ was a reviewer of that project, and I think he respects what that project is and does, but as he rightly points out, the BCAP project is not trying to be prescriptive. It's not trying to say, here's how you should change Bitcoin, or here's the best way to change Bitcoin. That is not a goal.
Right.
It's in fact a non-goal to do that. It's simply trying to observe how Bitcoin doesn't change and does change, and not trying to be prescriptive. But so that leaves an omission, though, for people who believe they can improve Bitcoin and they want to change Bitcoin. There's really no guide out there or guidance on like, here's the best way to do it, or here's at least one way to do it from the perspective of someone who's a Bitcoin Core developer. And that's what he's created in the Bitcoin forking guide. And I reviewed it before he published it. I like what he's put together. There's probably going to be different reactions to it. Some people would be like, who is he to say this? But I mean, like, he's not saying this is the official guide for Bitcoin. It's just his view, but he has an experienced view. I mean, people should respect his view. People should have a look at that if they want to change Bitcoin, or if they're evaluating other people wanting to change Bitcoin. How are other people's approaches to changing Bitcoin? How does that compare to what AJ recommends? I think that's an interesting comparison for people. We talked about Taproot Wizards a week or two ago. There's a lot of their approach to how to change Bitcoin definitely has pros and cons, as we talked about. They definitely do a good job of creating awareness, but they definitely rub a lot of people the wrong way. And certainly their approach is inconsistent with what AJ recommends in this guide. So,
now that the guide's been written, if he were to go to them and share some of this, do you think they would be interested in it, or is it more just very different approach? Probably, sort of will work for some people and not for others.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think if you certain personality types are more likely to want to appreciate and follow this guide than other personality types, right? So everyone has strengths and weaknesses too. So if your strength is you're an expert troll, that's going to be the tool you reach into your toolbox, right? And if that's not what AJ is recommending in this Bitcoin forking guide, which if you say that three times really fast, I don't know what you'd actually be saying. I think that's part of it. Also, I would expect a reaction from most people trying to change Bitcoin right now that they'd be like, yeah, sounds good on paper, but you go try to change Bitcoin Core, right? It's hard. And even to get people's attention, to make it a priority. So I suspect many people who have tried and failed to change Bitcoin would read this and just roll their eyes and be like, nice theory, doesn't work in practice, right?
Could you summarize the theory a little bit? Like I gave maybe just a high level statement. I don't know if consensus before consensus is a good summary, but is there any other kind of like nuance or kind of summarization that you could provide?
Yeah. So unless you pull it up, I might not get all the details here, but you certainly start with developers. You propose a technical change and you have some substance and meat to the technical change, and you go ahead and go to his actual web page.
So this one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the number one, research and development. So that's like the developer level. And then his suggestion for number two is like more use case driven and like actually build prototypes and demonstrate value of this change versus just a technical spec. And then third is when you do a broader outreach beyond relatively small segments of people to get industry reaction. Valuation reaction, and then finally engage investors. Most critically, don't even be talking about activation methods until you're past all four of these steps. He has activation at the end. And I think he's, even suggesting like don't even talk to miners until I forget exactly what's in finalization, but I think, miners are engaged, I think step five or sort of towards the end. I gave a little bit of feedback there saying like, shouldn't they be engaged earlier? But I think, it's a little bit dependent on the change too. If it's a change that impacts miners, their business or, then you'd want to engage earlier. If it's pretty much independent of the industry of mining and their business, then he's proposing that they don't need to be engaged until later. And of course, the research and development, any of these stages, they're public. I mean, anyone can participate at any point they want. So you can be an investor, and an investor can more than happy to be a Bitcoin Core dev and engage that level. So it's not like these are permissioned, but these would be like the intentionality is. These
kind of archetypes of the personalities you want to approach with these. Yeah.
And I would, so I generally agree with this guide and this approach. And I think AJ even says, it's not official. It's not the standard. It's not the only way. There's many approaches. But like, again, if someone wants to change Bitcoin and they want to follow best practices and have the highest probability of chance, I think this is it. I do think this or something similar to this gives you the highest chance. Gives you the highest chance of getting your change into Bitcoin Core, which if you read BCAP and study that project, I would call that, an enormous, requirement almost to get a change through. Are there ways to change Bitcoin without getting into Bitcoin Core? Yes, but those are like almost, nuclear option type things. Very low probability event. Very leads to a very fragile Bitcoin network. So, anyone earnestly looking to change Bitcoin to improve it, my opinion, they should be looking at the path to get it into Bitcoin Core, and following AJ's guide is a great starting point for how to get that done.
Is there any way to, I understand that, because Bitcoin, these types of decisions are not centralized, they could come from anywhere and they could be read by anybody and there's not really like a process. But is there anywhere, like if I wanted to look right now at maybe a web page, maybe there's a GitHub or something, is there anywhere that I could see like the maybe some of the most interesting or the ones with enough consensus of like, what are the current outstanding issues? Like I understand opcat might be some issue that somebody cares about. I don't know how much seriousness that has versus, how much is it reality versus perception, but is there anywhere that I can sort of see as sort of an outsider observing it? How can I just sort of see what's going on? Like what are the top 10 issues in Bitcoin right now?
I mean, that's a complicated answer because the examples I think what you're insinuating is like consensus changes. And that's what a lot of people think about when they, to improve Bitcoin or change Bitcoin is a consensus change. But I think that's like really misplaced. And in fact, this like, a year ago, there was, kind of a hubbub about Michael Saylor not wanting, not supporting Bitcoin developers and the ossification and stuff like that. But, if you really got to dive into the details about what changes are we talking about? Like, and something I pointed out, 99% of change, like software changes for Bitcoin, whether it's lines of code or PRs or commits or whatever measurement tool you want, are not consensus changes. Right. So like most of the change that occurs to the Bitcoin Core project itself and many other projects that impact Bitcoin aren't consensus changes. And so to answer your question, well, I mean, one is like, how do you observe what are all the top issues or things going on non-consensus changes within Bitcoin Core? But what about other projects too, like mining protocols and Lightning, et cetera? But then within consensus changes, there's, that's another category. So I don't know what it really depends on the context. Like if we're just talking about like a casual observer, someone in Silicon Valley who just wants to know like what are the top 10 Bitcoin development topics or whatever, I'd say like Bitcoin OpTech is one great resource. There's the weekly newsletter. It's quite technical, but like it at least takes really technical topics and distills them into somewhat digestible. I mean, it does a great job at it creating digestible pieces, but it still is quite technical. But that's a weekly newsletter. And then that library of content, also there's a topic database within the Bitcoin OpTech website. We can include that in show notes. That's one way to stay on top of sort of all things happening in Bitcoin development. There's like some wiki page like with different covenant consensus change proposal. There's also some covenants website that can be looked at. So if you just care about covenant proposals, there's resources that people have created for that. But it really, I mean, to answer that question, there just has to be clarity on what you're actually trying.
Right. So there's consensus and non-consensus, and neither of them really have any type of home. You kind of have to.
There's tons of improvements to Bitcoin. Yeah, improvements on privacy and security, and so many different and scaling in so many different areas. You know, to answer that question, like how fine a grain of detail do you want? Which scope? Which area of interest do you want?
Right.
To answer that question. And frankly, you know, and because it's decentralized, like there's not just one website to go to that has all this information. This doesn't exist.
Yep. All right. We got a minute. Do we have time to talk? Bitcoin probably, contributions.
It's kind of related. It's kind of related to we've been talking about the Bitcoin Core project a little bit. This is a report that has been produced, I think, 6 straight years now. The regular contributors to Bitcoin Core are surveyed every year. I think it's been a pretty consistent survey year to year, so pretty good year to year comparisons. And just gives a pulse of the project. Given the people who are, most of the core contributors do respond to this. I believe, it's probably honest responses. So I think it's pretty quality data, and it just gives a sense for like the health of the project. Actual contributors' views on what's going well, not going well, what is important to them, not important to them. If you scroll up a little bit, you can sort of see where. Go down, please. Here. Interested in learning more about. This tells you what active core developers interest them from technological developments, right? So notice that Covenants, which is misspelled, I believe, is number 4. It had 4 survey respondents indicating that. So it's pretty high up in the list. And actually, there's not a lot of, like, the top 5 are all about the same number of votes or whatever, but that gives you a sense for like where their heads are at, their interests are at. But I think this could be healthy to look at. Like, some people are so passionate about Covenants, or like literally, like some people, like it's the only thing that they think matters to Bitcoin and improving Bitcoin. And we need champions like that. I mean, I myself champion things like Bolt 12, and some people would be like, "What? Why does this guy think Bolt 12 or Stratum V2 are like the be all end all of Bitcoin? They're just 2 little pieces of Bitcoin. They matter, and that list there, all that matters. Covenants matters too, but anyone who's like super passionate about one particular topic, just realize there's other passionate Bitcoiners who think other things are important too. And most of these things are important, right? And so that list there, I think, is an interesting list of things that are important to Bitcoin, and it's where their heads are at.
Great. Well, fortunate for you, we have run out of time, and I have not asked you about is the gold in Fort Knox yet? So you get to avoid that this week, but watch out, because next week I ask you such a thing.
All right. Looking forward to it.
We'll see you.
All right. Bye, David. Bye, everyone.